Welcome once again to One Step Beyond. If you've listened before, welcome to One Step Beyond. If you haven't, my name is Dave Emery. I'm the producer and host of the show, and it is a political phone-in talk show, somewhat different probably than what you're accustomed to hearing. It is my hope this evening to have an interview with Monica Jensen Stevenson and her husband William Stevenson. They are the co-authors of a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. That book has been recently published, and there was an article, or actually a column about it, in the San Francisco Examiner last Thursday, specifically another in the excellent series of columns that's been done by Warren Hinkle on Thursdays in the Examiner for some months running now. He calls the columns the series he's doing, George Bush and the Drug Wars, and this past Thursday there was an excellent column about Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Warren Hinkle, and it talks about Monica Jensen Stevenson, or actually more about her husband, William Stevenson. I have Monica Jensen Stevenson and William Stevenson, respectively, on the phone. They are calling from Toronto, and we are going to do an interview about their book. They are the co-authors of a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, subtitled How the United States Betrayed Its Own POWs in Vietnam. Again, Monica Jensen Stevenson and William Stevenson. William Stevenson, known to this audience as the author of both The Borman Brotherhood and A Man Called Intrepid. This is published in hardcover by Dutton Books and is copyright 1990. It has just come out. Apparently, in today's Washington Post, there is a reference to some material from this particular book. I'm going to read you a brief bio of each of the co-authors from the inside flap here. Monica Jensen Stevenson is a former magazine editor who started her career in TV journalism in Canada as a reporter and producer for CTV. In 1981, she moved to CBS TV's 60 Minutes as a staff producer and worked there for 6 years. She won a gold medal for Best TV Documentary at the New York International Film and TV Festival for one of her CTV productions and an Emmy for her mini-documentary, quote, In the Belly of the Beast, unquote. She writes regularly for the Toronto Star. William Stevenson first encountered the Far East as a Royal Navy fighter pilot and returned to Asia at the outbreak of the Korean War as a correspondent for the Toronto Star, later traveling for the Star in China and Southeast Asia and covering the final French defeat in Vietnam. He is the author of A Man Called Intrepid and 90 Minutes at Entebbe, and his television credits include a period as staff producer and co-host with Alistair Burnett of Dateline, ITV's nightly news program from London, and one as correspondent and producer for CBC-TV. So that, in a nutshell, is a biography of who these authors are, and we will be speaking with them this evening. So I'm going to see now if our technology is working properly and if we make the phone connection. Good evening, Monica Jensen Stevenson, William Stevenson. Can you hear me?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, you are now live in front of the Bay Area. I have read the bios of each of you respectively from the inside flap of the book, so the audience is familiar with your backgrounds. And I should also add that this audience is familiar with William Stevenson's work, both from A Man Called Intrepid and also The Borman Brotherhood as well. Probably the best place to start in a discussion of this book is, I guess you could say, how you, that is to say, how Monica Jensen Stevenson became involved with the whole issue of POWs and MIAs in Vietnam while working for 60 Minutes.
Well, I began to look at this story, a rather mild version of it, simply looked at the possibility of whether men were alive in Indochina, whether prisoners had been left behind. And some very strange things for me at that time began to happen. First, I got a call from a colonel on the National Security Council who was in charge of this issue, who told me to drop the story. And then he proceeded to tell me about everyone I had spoken to. And he knew everyone I had spoken to, and then went on to slander each one of them. And they were all very highly respectable people. They were people in the military, people who had retired from the military, included former intelligence chiefs, families of the missing, quite often people who had long military histories themselves, and all people who had given a substantial part of their lives in service to their countries. And I knew that they were very solid. And when he saw that I was persisting in the story, he then proceeded to tell me that if I went ahead with it, I could very well be responsible for the deaths of the men still over there. And you know, I wasn't a novice journalist, but this really shocked me and surprised me. And then I continued to be shocked and surprised because this kind of thing, this kind of threatening and intimidation, had happened to most of the people who had been involved in this issue and who dared to tell the truth about it. And I knew that that they were telling the truth because I was getting incredible information, intelligence on the men who had been abandoned. And I should really state right off the bat that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee minority staff has just issued an interim report. They've done an investigation on this. And the one thing they say is that the most startling thing they discovered was that in the first year after the war, the Pentagon definitely knew that men had been left behind, live prisoners, yet they operated and took a public position that those men were all dead. And that's what I ran across right from the beginning of doing that story.
Now, many people listening to this story for the first time, and this is not the first time that I personally have heard information of this kind. One of the people in your book, Colonel Bo Greitz, has received a fair amount of publicity in connection with the whole POW-MIA issue. But a lot of people hearing this for the first time would be asking themselves, well, why? Why would the United States government attempt to block a journalist who is doing honest work in a very important area? Why would the American government, in effect, or elements thereof, take action to suppress the truth about American fighting men in Vietnam, particularly when the American right wing, which obviously is quite close to the national security establishment, there are elements of each that are more or less intersecting. When the right wing has made such a vocal issue of the POW-MIA issue, why, a lot of people I'm sure would ask themselves, would the government be taking steps to intimidate you, intimidate other people, frustrate the investigation, and perhaps even go farther than that if we read perhaps what was meant to be read into the death of one of the people in your book, Jerry Daniels?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, there's right wing and there's right wing. This is, there's left wing and left wing. And one of the interesting things that has happened in the writing of this book, and already began to happen when I worked on this story for 60 Minutes, is that the right and left and middle agree on one thing, and that is that we can't have the kinds of abuses of secrecy that is exhibited by this story. I mean, intelligence, if it has any priority, should have a priority, the defense of people who give their lives and offer their lives for their country. And in this instance, not only did the intelligence communities not do their job in protecting those men, they opted to harass and behave as like the Gestapo to the families of the men or to anyone who took a line that was different to their position. And we have, in the writing of this book, had support from both right and left and middle. I mean, it really is an issue on which everyone has come together. If you've read the book, I'm sure you noticed that that one of our strongest supporters is Danny Sheehan of the Christic Institute.
Right. I was noticing that one of the chapters, for the benefit of the listenership that has not read the book, one of the chapters is in fact titled "The Billionaire" or "The Radical, the Billionaire, and the Green Beret," talking about respectively H. Ross Perot of Controlled Data Systems, also obviously Danny Sheehan, the quote radical, and the Green Beret is presumably Bo Greitz.
Right.
And there is indeed a considerable convergence of information and opinion from what are usually portrayed as divergent ideological elements, those three being a good example. One of the things that is, I think, well, obviously it figures very strongly in your book, and one of the things that is most important and I think potentially most shocking to listeners was the chilling reference to, quote, liquidate the merchandise when one of the people that you discuss, Jerry Daniels, nicknamed Hot Dog Daniels, a CIA and mercenary type who had operated for many years in Southeast Asia, he and a fellow named Scott Barnes had come across very firm evidence of that, among other people, they had come across very firm evidence of live POWs and MIAs in Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. And I think that the order that was given to, quote, liquidate the merchandise, in other words, get rid of these POWs and MIAs, and that story, the story of that particular mission, in many ways goes to the heart of your book and what it's about. Why don't you go into the Barnes Daniel's mission and that particular aspect, and why, in your opinion, they were asked to liquidate the merchandise, quote-unquote.
Bill, do you want to address this?
The whole problem is this, that the people talk about the government controlling the issue. Why did the government, for example, try to stop Monica from going ahead with the story in 1985-86? When really we're talking about what some people have called a second government, and that is a group of people who are pursuing their own policies quite independently of any oversight by Congress, independently of any presidential sanction, for that matter. And in the case of Gerald Daniels and this order to liquidate the merchandise, that is probably the best example, single example. There are lots of others, and we haven't even tried to cover those in the book because it's impossible in a readable, short, relatively short book to go into all these cases. But at the time that this particular incident took place, you had, on the one hand, good Americans in the armed forces trying to get people out of prison camps in Cambodia and Laos, where there'd been secret war. And you had, opposing them, the people who are committed to a policy independent of the U.S. government. And the people who had sent in the mission wanted to get some kind of visual evidence of American prisoners. The people controlling the issue were determined to stop that evidence coming out. And to this very day, that seems to us to be the situation. We have been told that if an American prisoner were to reach one of the neutral borders today, the biggest danger he would face would be the moment he crossed that frontier into neutral territory, because there are people on this side who want to get rid of any kind of living evidence. Bones they can take, but not live Americans.
And one of the things that was interesting to me, too, about the official response, I guess you could say, to the efforts of people like Jerry Daniels and Scott Barnes. Jerry Daniels died under mysterious circumstances. He did not return alive from the mission where he was ordered to liquidate the merchandise. And Scott Barnes suffered a very serious knife wound, which he claimed was a warning to him. And apparently, if I remember correctly, he also had several shots fired strategically close to his head, I guess.
Well, Barnes has been a good example of somebody who is discredited. He's not the ideal example of a perfectly well-behaved person who is not vulnerable to that kind of discrediting. But in the case of Daniels, he was a full-time intelligence operative, very well skilled in working with the Hmong, who were the controlled assets of the CIA in Laos. And Daniels, in our opinion, came to the conclusion that the Hmong, these hill tribe people who grow opium in that area and have for years financed their lives by growing opium, Daniels had reached a point where he was willing to close his eyes to the illegal drug smuggling and the method of supporting those activities by selling illegal drugs, but he could not close his eyes to deliberately turning his back on American prisoners. Scott Barnes seems to us to have been a young man who got into this at a very early stage in his life when he was pretty impressionable and slowly got sucked into activities that more and more put him, in a technical sense, on the wrong side of the law. Now, you can do a lot of illegal things for intelligence services believing that you're doing them in a good cause. But if you cross up your masters in those secret services, they can then turn around, disown you, and say you were a criminal, you broke the law. And I think this is what happened to Scott Barnes. He came back, he refused to go ahead with, as did Gerald. Gerald Daniels didn't want to go ahead with the order. They came back from the area where they were operating, and Daniels then died in very mysterious circumstances. No explanation really for why he died in the way he did. According to the Thai police report, it was a gas leak. Yet another man in the same apartment was not in any way affected by it. Barnes, for his part, was clever enough to get out of the Thai area and back into the States. But since then, he has been continually harassed. And each time he tries to tell his version of what happened, he is attacked physically, or he is discredited, or he is targeted by people who are expert in disinformation.
And the important thing for me and working on that is that I really talk to people who were directly knowledgeable about that mission. In other words, people inside the most secret unit in the Pentagon at the time who had direct knowledge of it. And they confirmed many of the things that Barnes was talking about. You know, I have no confirmation of whether he actually saw what he saw when he says he saw those prisoners. But certainly I have confirmation of the fact that that mission took place, that it was sabotaged to some degree, that it was taken over by elements that confused a lot of people, and that the unit, this is ISA within the Pentagon itself, suffered, tremendous setbacks after that. So I know that reporters, for example, there was an LA Times reporter who interviewed us, and she focused strictly on that case, and she kept saying, well, our reporter checked it out, and he's completely a flake, and there's no substance to it. Well, I don't know what their reporter did. Maybe he checked the hotel registries. But I do know that the sources I spoke to were talking from an absolute position of authority, and they confirmed a lot of what went on that mission.
The Los Angeles Times hatchet job a couple of weeks ago was a good example of this disinformation. It did not address the subject of the book. It tried to make Monica look as if she was obsessive, which is a standard procedure with all the attacks on anybody who tries to take a serious look at this issue. And it avoided entirely the nub of what we're saying, which is that there has been a deliberate policy of hiding any evidence, any even conceivably credible evidence, of American prisoners ever since 1973, when the U.S. government had committed itself to the position that there were no American prisoners left behind, when in fact there were at least 3,000 left behind.
By the way, an ISA that the audience heard Monica referring to stands for Intelligence Support Activity. That's the unit she was talking about.
That's right, and the Intelligence Support Activity, you see, represents the Army's concerns, and there has been, really, not to put a too fine point on it, there's been a fight going on, a battle going on between the CIA covert operations people and the Army intelligence people who feel that their primary duty is to look after their own people, which should, in fact, be the primary duty of any intelligence service.
One of the things that struck me as I read the book was a relatively short statement that some of the people who had offered some of the most firm resistance to your 60 Minutes documentary, Dead or Alive, Monica, were people who had been associated with former CIA agent Edwin Wilson, who figures prominently in your book as well. Who were some of those people?
Well, I think that we sort of have to put that in context. And let me explain, first of all, that, there was a very strong effort made to kill our book. And the effort was led by a man who had a very high position in covert operations. And he wrote letters, in effect, threatening, and our publisher then seemed to succumb to that. In other words, he dropped the book. It was only because the Canadian publisher, the largest Canadian publisher, McCullen and Stewart, picked it up, that we were then able to move forward, and then it was sold to the States again. But another effort was made this year, just 5-6 months ago, with similar letters written. So that in dealing with the subject that you've asked right now, about right now, we talk about the people sort of throughout the intelligence agencies who have controlled this issue. We do not give specific names in that sense other than what is in the book. I mean, we were able to deal with Ed Wilson because he's in prison. But, Bill, do you want to take that over and take it as far as we can go?
The whole point is that the only way to get the book published was to try and satisfy the libel insurance lawyers. And libel insurance lawyers today have got a hammerlock on publishing in America. And the libel insurance lawyers just did not want to even take the faintest risk of having libel actions brought against the book that, although they would have no merit and would in the end fail, nonetheless would draw upon bottomless sources of money available to secret operations that would make it impossible for the publisher really to his way right through the lawsuit. And this had been done already to another book, Out of Control, by Leslie Coven, published by Atlantic Press. And reference was made to that case in a boastful way to warn off the other publishers. So we ended up having to, as late as June, go very carefully through everything in the book with the libel lawyers to make absolutely sure that even a phony case could not be brought against the book and either stop it getting published or subsequently make the publishers regret publishing it and therefore driving off other publishers from touching on the same subject. And this is perhaps the most sinister aspect of the whole thing, that here we have the American system being used against Americans in this particular way. But that explains why, in the end, we had to get around certain elements in the story. But we think that the story still stands up. But you see, it exposes us to the kind of attack that the Los Angeles Times permitted to take place, in which it is said, we do not really know names. We have given the identities of all our sources to the investigators who are lawfully now looking into this whole issue on behalf of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I can tell you that one of the key people who led the attack on the book was a man who was also in charge of the POW issue for the Pentagon, and he was the head of covert operations. And he was nominated for three positions last year. One was for Secretary of Defense, one for Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy, and Deputy Secretary for Southeast Asian Affairs. And he, in the final one, he withdrew from both his job as head of covert operations and the Secretary of the Army, and the New York Times said that he could not stand up to the Senate grilling. And that was why he resigned. So that will give you some kind of an idea of what we had to struggle against.
One of the people that you were able to name and whose revelations or whose discussion really figure prominently in the book, and a fellow who intersects with many of the people who figure in your book, is Edwin Wilson, the fellow you mentioned some time ago. Wilson, of course, is a former CIA agent who was convicted of selling explosives and doing a lot of other things in Libya. He claims he was working in an official capacity for the U.S. government, and the evidence points in that respect, in that direction, although certainly Wilson also, as did many of his associates and many of the people referred to in the book, utilized his government work for private gain, and often the distinction between the two, as was the case with the Iran-Contra scandal, is blurry. Or many of the Iran-Contra operation, I should say, the distinction between official service and private operations becomes quite the dividing line becomes quite blurry. But Edwin Wilson referred to a group of people in Southeast Asia who basically were embittered at the Washington establishment, I guess you could say, and it saw the politicians in Washington as a bunch of Marxists and pinkos, and that they, Wilson says that they felt that from that point forward, and the year was mentioned as 1973, that covert operations should be free of sentiment, so to speak, and that the war against communism should be unimpeded by legislative and democratic niceties the way Vietnam was. He also then discusses the trafficking of the huge amount of arms that was left in Southeast Asia and Vietnam in particular at the end of the war, and refers to the same group having moved them. To what extent do you feel that that group of operatives that Wilson spoke about and their related activities figures in the cover-up and the various forms of pressure that have been exerted on the people that have attempted to bring this story to light, bearing in mind the pressure both on the families of MIAs, the pressure that was brought to bear on your documentary, Monica, the pressure that's been brought to bear on the various people like Scott Barnes, Bo Greitz, and others. Who knows, Jerry Daniels, for all we know. We don't know what kind of pressure he was subjected to before his mysterious death. To what extent do you feel that this group of people referred to by Edwin Wilson figures in the activities that are the focus of your book, namely the cover-up of the POW MIA issue?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, because the one most important thing operating here is that, one, there was a 14-year secret war going on before 1973, and none of the men who were lost in that war, in Laos, for example, or Cambodia, came back. They were simply written off. And this is even though the Laotians said, you know, we have your prisoners and you have to negotiate with us for them. You can't just negotiate with the North Vietnamese. We didn't negotiate. And so about 600 men, for sure, and probably a lot more, were deliberately abandoned. And this is something that has now been confirmed by the report that was just released today. But that is not where it ended. And you're right about that group of people who felt that the war had been lost and need not have been lost and could indeed still be won. And they continued with their covert activities, and the way those covert activities were financed, because they weren't financed by Congress any more than at all. And they were financed through illegal means, like the illegal sale of arms and drugs. And they continued that until very recently, until this year. And they continued it even with such extreme things as supporting the Khmer Rouge. And anyone who looked at the prisoner issue couldn't help but become aware of that. And so, you know, anybody who looked at it had to be smashed, had to be discredited and discounted. And they have been very effective in doing that. I mean, so much so that the people with the integrity to speak out about this in the intelligence services themselves, like General Eugene Tai, who was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in all those critical years after the war, up to 1981, and who said he made this issue a priority, and he had all the facts, and based on what he knew, the men were definitely there. Even someone like General Tai had to be discredited, and that was done. I mean, he was very badly humiliated and put down, and this was done again because he had access to all of the material again in 1986 and 87 when he headed a commission, came to the same conclusion based on the classified intelligence at that time. They immediately classified the report and then proceeded to discredit him.
The individual in question is a General Tighe, last name T-I-G-H-E, who was the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. That's who Monica's referring to, for the benefit of the audience, again, that have not read the book.
That's right.
In connection with the illegal financing of this carrying forward, literally, of the hostilities in Southeast Asia, and this sort of team of perpetual covert operators, I guess one might term them, two of the institutions whose names weave in and out of the chronicle of Kiss the Boys Goodbye are BBRDW, Bishop Baldwin, Rewald, Dillingham, and Wong, and the infamous Nugenhan Bank, both names that are familiar to this audience and that have been listening for part or all of the decade plus that I've been doing these programs. But both of them are CIA or U.S. intelligence-connected operations, Nugenhan working in connection with both the CIA and Naval Intelligence, among others. To what extent could you outline the role played by both of those institutions in the piecing together of the role played by those institutions in the activities that figure in your book that you were researching?
Well, we know that BBRDW, which was the successor of the Nugenhan, both in financial institutions, for example, was used as a conduit for financing certain rescue operations. The conflict here has been between those who really wanted to rescue prisoners, and they were the military guys, either through the intelligence activity or through special forces, in conflict with the ideologists who believe that the enemy is communist Vietnam and must be beaten at all costs, no matter what, and who take the position that the American prisoners are of secondary importance, are not important at all. Oh. American Hand, which was set up in Australia with a huge board of people recruited from the armed forces, was used to launder drug money, primarily, and then took off in other directions. It, for example, handled money from the Middle East, being earned by Americans who didn't want to have to go through the IRS audits and so on. And when one of the directors, one of the executives of Nugan Hand, was found shot dead in Australia, a police inquiry began. And the cops, as you know, when they work as ordinary policemen, are very, very good at what they do. And the original police reports out of Australia had comments such as, there were so many American generals and admirals and military leaders on the boards of this company that they could have fought a war on their own. But as time went by, and this became a big political hot potato, a royal commission was commissioned to take over and issue a very voluminous report that, on the face of it, is a whitewash. But if you read it very carefully, it is quite clear that the Nugan Hand Bank was well known to the Australian government to be, in fact, a CIA proprietary, that is, a controlled organization. What would worry, I think, any objective observer is this, that if the CIA could run that operation into the ground by making totally bad judgments, calling bad judgments, on financial investments and so on, based on their inside knowledge, it's a pretty good measure of how inefficient they were in other ways.
And, well, of course, the way we initially hit on it, I don't know if that was your question, is that the DDRW bank was actually involved in funding some of these POW missions, and the Scott Barnes one is the best example. I mean, we have the documentation that shows that amounts of money went to support that mission. But what is also interesting is that that part of the money seems to have been for the POW mission as simply a cover. I mean, they weren't really looking for POWs. They were using it to cover up other activities. And of course, the man who headed that felt that, he was very subtle in the way he put it, because he wasn't in too good a position. He was in prison for life and was still afraid, you know, that his family might be hurt. But he put it to this way, that in the past, such missions had been drug affiliated. And, the implication was that the Barnes mission was involved in a similar kind of thing.
Two of the elements that crop up in connection in your book with the drug traffic and its role in covert warfare in Southeast Asia, one is Site 85 in Laos, also the Laotian warlord Vang Pao, who was obviously, if not the major figure, certainly one of the major figures in the so-called secret war that the CIA and the United States were waging in Laos for many years at roughly the same time as the Vietnam War was going on. Vang Pao also was a fellow who apparently has used his considerable bankroll from the drug trade to finance covert operations for the U.S. and other bidders long after the formal conclusion of hostilities as well. And why don't you talk about, or would you tell us, I should say, about Vang Pao and where, in your opinion, he fits into the mosaic of missing POWs and MIAs that the government wants to have remain missing?
Well, Vang Pao is a plausible man. He goes back to the age of 13 to 14 being hired by the French during the Indochina period. The French had an opium monopoly. That's what it was known as officially, French government opium monopoly. And Vang Pao grew up in that atmosphere. The French used opium to finance, or help to finance, anti-communist operations by Vang Pao's people, the Hmong, in Laos. In a way, you know, one has to understand that a man growing up in that atmosphere, starting out as a young boy, then getting full military training by the French, and then subsequently being taken over by the Americans, accepts this as being the normal way of doing business in war. He had armies that grew opium. The opium was in some cases processed before being shipped out, in other cases shipped out and processed elsewhere, but it for him was a habit, and he saw no particular reason why it should be regarded as criminal. As the years have gone by, Vang Pao's become associated with the whole story of the secret war in Laos, and today those CIA directors who were involved in that secret war will try to say that, well, Vang Pao and the Mon and all these people were doing things that were independent of any official government policy in the United States. And, of course, this is where you get into the whole area of plausible deniability. If Vang Pao became inconvenient, then they would just deny him. Vang Pao today lives in California. He has, until recently, professed to be leading a resistance army inside Laos. From time to time in Thailand, reports are published claiming big victories. But what we see in so many of these examples of secret warfare controlled assets, as they're known to the CIA, is that after a while it becomes a business. And the business is claiming victories, running big propaganda campaigns, convincing everybody you're doing terrific things against the communists, particularly in the Indochina area, when in fact you're doing very little. I don't think anybody can objectively claim that the anti-communist guerrillas and covert warfare assets operating in Laos and Cambodia today have really got any hope at all of winning anything. And in our opinion, the zealotry of the anti-communist ideologists who've been in the United States controlling this issue is totally misplaced. It has, in fact, done more harm to true democracy than it could possibly ever have hoped to do by any other methods.
Now, before we get to the discussion of the current covert operations and their the use of POW MIA searches as covers for some of those things, staying with Vang Pao and also with Nguyen Han just for a minute, I know that there was one line which I found intriguing. Well, there are a number of references to Nguyen Han, but at one point in the book, there is a statement by Monica that many of the people she had interviewed, or many of the people she had met in her investigation, had mentioned Nguyen Han and how the story winds in and out of that operation, how the name Nguyen Han winds in and out of your narrative. Now, the Christic Institute, in their affidavit, has maintained that Vang Pao opium money was banked with Nguyen Han, and that this operation, that the Nguyen Han Vang Pao operation, occurred both during and after, immediately after the formal conclusion of U.S. involvement in hostilities in Southeast Asia. I was wondering if, in your investigations, you had come across any firm link between Nguyen Han and Vang Pao's operations.
Well, again, it's, you know, the whole art of running covert wars, the whole art of the intelligence services, is to have a distance between the government and the people carrying out these operations. And one of the most difficult things for the Royal Commission in Australia and by the Australian police, as an example, was to pin down the real connections. They could only indicate that from their investigations that there were things that did not stand up to any normal explanation. For example, Nguyen Han Bank, an Australian financial institution, had a huge branch in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand. There was no real reason for that. Chiang Mai at that time was a small, practically unknown area, and you know, what amount of business an international financial institute would hope to do there would be difficult to explain. another difficult thing to explain was that the head of the Mugenhand Bank was on one side a special forces man who'd been recruited into the CIA, and on the other hand, a pliable Australian businessman. When Mugenhand folded, went bankrupt, because the CIA was not able to anticipate correctly financial changes, and the whole operation wrapped up from sheer ordinary, plain, common bankruptcy, things were moved over to Hawaii under the very old, established financial institute of which Ronald Rewald was the head. And Ronald Rewald had no apparent qualification for being a financier or the head of such an operation. Rewald ended up in jail for one accident that occurred when the IRS began to investigate him and did not realize that they were investigating a CIA proprietary. By the time the problem was discovered, it was too late to stop the IRS from continuing to prosecute, but suddenly there appeared in the trial a man who had been magically transformed from being a CIA lawyer to being a lawyer in the trial. Ron Rewald was put away for life. Now, the first person to really investigate this thing in any detail was David Taylor, a producer for the British Broadcasting Corporation in Washington. David interviewed Ron Rewald extensively in jail and left the Los Angeles area to return to his post in Washington, arrived at National Airport, and was immediately jumped on by drug enforcement agents and accused of carrying drugs. They searched his bags. Of course, there was nothing in them. They dropped the whole thing very quickly when his White House press pass fell out of his pocket during the search. But the intent, there were two intents. One, it seems to us, was to try and discredit Taylor and, if possible, get him entrapped. In fact, he says that one of his great fears was that somebody might have planted some drugs in his baggage, but luckily he had not checked any baggage. He was carrying it. The second was to send a signal to other people not to mess around in this thing.
One of the things which seems to loom large in your investigation into the suppression of information about POWs and MIAs in Southeast Asia is the use of some of the missions used to search for POWs and MIAs as covers for, in fact, ongoing clandestine warfare in Southeast Asia. In connection with that, I also wanted to ask you about the third option, as Theodore Shackley puts it, which, if I am correctly understanding the thrust of your book, appears to me at least to be, in many ways, at the core of the difficulties you encountered, the core, it appears to me to be at the core of the military and strategic philosophy guiding those people who are using those POW MIA searches as fronts for various clandestine warfare operations. And it I guess goes in a way to the thrust of the question that I asked Monica earlier about the group of covert operatives that Ed Wilson alluded to, who had more or less stayed in business on their own, although also working on behalf of the government. Because it appears that third option thinking really lies at the core of an awful lot of the difficulties that beset you and other people who have attempted to bring this to light.
Well, that's right, because if you believe, as they do, that, you know, you have to win the war at all costs. You don't do a nuclear war, and you don't do a conventional war. And the answer to winning is with this covert kind of warfare. Then everything is geared toward that, and the men, and you need military men to fight that. You cannot just fight a war with intelligence people. You know, if people go into the agency, then they know what they're getting into, and they know that under certain circumstances they're expendable. But when you're fighting that kind of a war, you need military men to do it. Now, in some instances, the military men did know that they were being used for covert warfare, and you brought up Site 85 before. The men, the Air Force men, who were assigned to Site 85, which was a site that was responsible for the pinpoint bombing of North Vietnam, up until 1968, and then when it was overrun, as a matter of fact, that was the reason for the major bombing halt of that year. When you have men, and those men agreed that they, you know, would do this kind of work, but they were also promised, they and their families were promised that they would continue to have the protection that military men had.